order. This is hopefully our final night meeting, and I appreciate everybody being here. We'll try to move through the schedule as quickly as possible. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3316 and call Tim Martinez forward. I've asked Megan to get some materials, so she is on her way down from her office. So, welcome, Tim, and we're just looking for the summer key. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3316 permits merchants to accept credit card or debit card in payment for goods or services to require a credit card or debit card holder to provide identification. Declares provisions in contract between merchant and credit card or debit card issuer prohibiting a merchant from verifying identity to be against public policy and void. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tim?
Madam Chair.
You got a good bill here.
Madam Chair, thank you. Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association. The administrator summed up the bill very well. We just want to make sure under statute that merchants can ask. So when I show up and say I'm Betsy Close, the merchant can say, you know, I want to see some ID to back that up. I won't say simple, I won't say housekeeping, but we'd appreciate your support.
Question, Representative Kitts.
I know Betsy Close. And you're no Betsy Close.
Say, I wanted to ask you. So if the merchant is to ask for ID at this point, can the customer say, I'm not going to give it to you?
Madam Chair, well, if they're smart enough to know what the law says, they could.
Okay.
And, you know, we don't want to create any problems between the merchant and the Visa or MasterCard or those folks. And I just want to also put on the record, they can't write it down, they can't put any information down, they can just verify that, you know, through the ID that it is the person that's using the card.
Okay. Questions? Tim Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tim, is there information, this, as written, this is pretty open to any types of information a merchant might request. Is there any limit to the types of things a merchant can ask in terms of this bill, the way it's constructed?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, the expectation is that the merchant would say, you know, do you have a driver's license, do you have something else that has a picture on it? Many credit cards now are actually putting pictures on the card, but, you know, it's designed to just allow them to ask for another form of ID.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair,
Representative Kitts.
I would move House Bill 3316 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3316 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Rosenbaum.
I had no discussion.
You had no discussion. Okay, I'm sorry.
Bill, and I'm happy to support it.
Okay. Other discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Farrar. Aye.
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 Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries, and we will have Representative Cano carry his bill. Close the work session. Okay, should we go to the ones we're referring? I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3266. I have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3266 establishes credit against income or corporate excise tax for expansion and full-time employment by small employers, and it has a referral to the Revenue Committee.
Okay, committee, my purpose was in scheduling this. We really don't have time to hear it, but it had a subsequent referral to revenue, so my purpose was to refer it there, and if they have the time, then they can hear it.
Madam Chair.
President Kitts.
I would ask that we move House Bill 3266 to the Committee on Revenue.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3266 to the House Committee.
With no recommendation.
On revenue, with no recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries, and House Bill 3266 goes to revenue. Close the work session. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3276. Have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3276 expands state housing and loan guarantee programs to include purchase of lot and subdivided manufactured dwelling park by tenant. It has a prior referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you.
Okay, committee, here again, this is a bill that we would like to hear. We don't really have the time to hear it, and so we are intending to refer it to Ways and Means. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3276 to the Committee on Ways and Means with no recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3276 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation. Is there a discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Is excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries, and House Bill 3276 moves to Ways and Means. Close the work session. Okay, Representative Tomei is here, and so we will go to her bill next. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3088 and call Representative Tomei. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am State Representative Carolyn Tomei, representing House District 41, which encompasses the city of Milwaukee and part of Southeast Portland. Thank you for hearing House Bill 3088. This is legislation that defines and regulates predatory mortgage lending practices in the state of Oregon. Predatory mortgage lending does just what the term implies. It preys upon the most vulnerable of our citizens. Predatory lending is a term used for housing loans that impose high-cost terms. These loans tend to have ridiculously high fees and interest rates. Predatory lending unfairly targets low-income minorities and cash-poor, equity-rich senior citizens, offering loans with no regard to a borrower's ability to repay and leaving thousands unnecessarily homeless and in debt. According to Edward N. Gramlich, member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, predatory mortgage lending involves at least one, and perhaps all three, of the following elements, and I quote here: making unaffordable loans based on the assets of the borrower rather than on the borrower's ability to repay the obligation, that is, asset-based lending; inducing a borrower to refinance a loan repeatedly in order to charge high points and fees each time the loan is refinanced. The loan payments often force the borrower to refinance and being charged a few thousand dollars in points each time it's refinanced, and thereby increasing the amount of the loan, and this is known as loan flipping. And engaging in fraud or deception to conceal the true nature of the loan obligation from an unsuspecting or unsophisticated borrower. A common practice is home improvement scams, in which a contractor suggests a home refinance loan to pay for home improvements and then refers a customer to a specific lender. The refinance amount typically far exceeds the cost of improvements, which increases the homeowner's debt. Just last fall, Household International Incorporated, a lending institution, chose to settle a multi-state action with borrowers for $484 million. $7 million or more will be paid in restitution to Oregonians for households' alleged unfair and deceptive lending practices. The Oregonian, a couple of years ago, did a series of articles regarding these practices and people who lost their homes. Practices identified in this action are not unique to household, however, but represent the current practices of many lenders that make high-cost mortgage loans. Household violated federal laws such as the Homeowner Equity Protection Act and the Truth in Lending Act, and Oregon laws regulating mortgage lenders by misrepresenting loan terms and failing to disclose material information to borrowers. Borrowers complained that households charged far higher interest rates than promised. They charged costly prepayment penalties, and they were deceptive concerning insurance policies. Frequently, they require that you have either a health or a life insurance policy, which can raise the payment per month as much as $300 or more. Consumers were trapped in costly loans. From January 99 through September 2002, more than 5,000 Oregonians took out real estate loans from households. This is just in Oregon. Under the settlement, these Oregon consumers are eligible to recover approximately $7 million. The grievances against household include their failure to properly inform consumers of loan costs and insurance premiums. Borrowers were led to believe that they were receiving interest rates of about 7 or 8% when they were actually charged twice that much. They were also charged costly prepayment penalties that were not clearly disclosed to them. The issue of predatory lending has grown significantly every year. The industry grew from $20 billion in 1993 to $150 billion in 1998. The effects of this growth are clear, as home foreclosures increased fourfold between 1990 and 1998, despite a strong economy. House Bill 388, based on New York's recent anti-predatory lending law, defines all three types of predatory lending, making it possible for the Department of Justice to prosecute illegal predatory lending practices. Currently, the Department of Justice Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Section deals with lending practice complaints, but its authority is limited by current statute. The solution? Under House Bill 3088, the remedies include: lenders cannot accelerate or increase payments on high-cost loans at their own discretion or increase interest rates after a high-cost loan is defaulted. If the loan is a refinance loan, lenders cannot schedule payments over twice the size of the previous payments or encourage the borrower to default on the current loan. Lenders cannot charge fees for making changes to a high-cost loan, charge fees outside their normal fee schedule, or include fees over 3% of the principal amount. Predatory lenders cannot mandate unfair arbitration, participate in loan flipping, or make high-cost loans without regard to the borrower's ability to repay. A lender under a high-cost loan may not make direct payment to a contractor under a home improvement loan. Lenders will be less able to hide predatory terms as they will be required to disclose a high-cost loan to the borrower and provide a list of state-approved credit counselors to the borrower before a high-cost loan can be made. This will not cut out high-cost loans, but it will make sure that people realize what the terms are of these loans and that they may have other options. These practices are affecting Oregonians every day. 287 complaints regarding mortgage lending practices were filed with the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs here in Oregon between 1999 and 2002. This number is clearly an understatement of those being affected. Again, approximately 5,000 Oregonians will receive restitution from the recent household settlement. That is just one company. 5,000 Oregonians affected by the predatory lending practices, as I said, of one company alone. Several states, including California, Connecticut, Georgia, Illinois, New York, North Carolina, and Ohio, have begun passing anti-predatory lending regulations. The effects of this legislation are promising. North Carolina's 1999 anti-predatory lending law saved homeowners $100 million and prevented over 31,000 predatory terms on mortgage loans in the year 2000. As anti-predatory lending legislation makes its way into more states, authorizing attorneys general to pursue unlawful lenders, the predatory lending practices of companies such as Household are becoming more difficult. House Bill 3088 defines what constitutes high cost and potentially predatory lending practices and holds those lenders to a higher level of scrutiny crucial in protecting Oregonians from this practice. It does not affect lenders making ethical, fair mortgage loans. The bill protects Oregonians at a time when they are most vulnerable and they need protection. Again, thank you for your consideration of this vital and much-needed legislation. I've included in your packets, I hope you've gotten them, a letter from Peggy Michael at the Fair Housing Council. Please do read this. She makes a very compelling argument why this bill is desperately needed. Now, the suit that we saw that happened a couple of years ago did not take care of all these problems. They are still happening. She's seeing it every day, as is Peg Malloy, who is executive director of the Portland Housing Center. And just recently in the Portland Tribune, I gave you an article about a woman who was losing her home. This is a woman who is a pillar of her community. And she's losing her home from one of these predatory lending practices. So it is definitely still a problem in Oregon, one that I think we have a responsibility to address. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Tomei. I think that's very complete testimony. I'm going to call a panel of three: David Nibble, Pam Harkins, Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm going to limit the panel to 1 minute each in the interest of time.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Nibble. I work for the Oregon Law Center. I have some written testimony that's being distributed that I won't. I'll let you read at your leisure. In light of the time constraints, I want to make just a couple points. One is that one of the most important parts of this bill is the part that deals with what we call S&E liability. That means that if one of these loans is made and then sold to another holder, if the borrower defaults, under this provision, the debtor would be able to use the defenses that would be provided in this bill as defenses against a foreclosure. Currently, under current law, I think that the borrower in that situation would be able to assert defenses or perhaps a lawsuit against, or for fraud or whatever, against the original mortgage company, but would not be able to assert the defenses against the holder of the note on default. The only other thing I would mention, just to give you a fuller idea of the situation that puts people into these loans, we're generally talking, or in many cases, we're talking about low-income people who have been living in homes for a long period of time, who have substantial equity in these homes. They may have low income, for example, SSI, and they maybe have very low house payments. These folks get involved in these loans to maybe pay off extra bills and find themselves unable to make the payments on their loans. They default, their mortgages are foreclosed, and they lose their homes and are no longer and are effectively homeless or have to make other arrangements. So this does have definite impacts, and especially in places like North Portland, Northeast Portland, and increasingly far Southeast Portland.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheryl?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Just very quickly, Cheryl Pellegrini, Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Fraud, Consumer Protection Section. The department does support this bill for the reason that was cited by Representative Tomei, and that it does give authority under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to the Attorney General to investigate alleged violations within the bill. In the household finance case, I would only point out that the case was problematic for Oregon because the Attorney General lacked authority to investigate the allegations, and DCBS, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, also only has limited jurisdiction over households' activities in Oregon. So neither agency really was able to participate in the investigation to the extent that, for example, our sister state, Washington, did to determine the amount of harm caused to Oregon consumers. This bill would remedy that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Pam.
Good evening, Chair Close and members of the committee. My name is Pam Harkins. I'm the Associate State Director with AARP Oregon, and I'm here in support of House Bill 3088 because predatory lending is an issue nationwide that AARP has started to combat. We see it as a growing problem amongst the older population who are often homeowners, and they are targeted by predatory lenders for that reason. It's our understanding that the bill has been patterned after the New York State legislation, which AARP spent 2 years in helping to design and pass. And it's because of that that we can lend our support to it. We are certainly willing to assist in any way we can in education. We have publications already out there, and we're working in multiple states to try to combat this problem. Thank you, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Call Jim Markey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Jim Markey, representing the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association this evening, as well as the United Financial Lobby, a group of lender folks, including the Oregon Credit Union League, the Oregon Bankers Association, the Oregon Association of Mortgage Brokers, the Oregon Association of Mortgage Lenders, and the Oregon Financial Services Association. I'll be brief. My client, the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, as well as the United Financial Lobby, is opposed to House Bill 3088. Frankly, Representative Vicki Walker introduced a bill on predatory lending last session. We spent a lot of time last session talking about whether predatory lending did or did not exist in Oregon and what it really was and what ought to be done about it if it did. From those discussions was created a work group that spent a year and a half during the interim period looking at predatory lending, trying to define predatory lending. We spent probably five meetings just talking about how any one of us might define predatory lending, because predatory lending, it turns out, is kind of in the eye of the beholder. What might be predatory in one situation might be the best possible loan for somebody else in a different situation. The result of many, many meetings was a report that was actually written by my good friend David Niebel, and I thought he did an excellent job and a very fair job in trying to outline what it was that we were looking at in Oregon. Basically, I would have to say that we couldn't find any evidence that predatory lending, if we could agree on a definition, actually exists to any great extent in Oregon, if at all. There was some anecdotal information. Department of Justice came in and said they had 38 complaints. My son Matt had the good sense to ask him over what period of time. That was over a three-year period. Department of Consumer and Business Services has had 70 or 80 or 90 complaints a year. Generally, those are, when you look at those complaints, most of them are some misunderstanding between a mortgage broker and the client, or some other miscommunication, or some minor detail. They are, however, I will say, hard to track. And I think DCBS is really trying to do a better job in tracking those complaints and looking to those compliance issues. In Oregon, we've chosen to regulate lenders through Department of Consumer and Business Services. This bill would extend the Oregon Unfair Trade Practices Act to lending for the first time ever, and that is a significant change and one that you shouldn't look at lightly. There are, I guess, other things in the bill that we would find objectionable. But let me just say, so that I don't go on, that I believe that the answer to any reaction to predatory lending needs, in the end, to come from the federal government, because all of these folks that are involved in the lending industry deal in more than one state. And for one state to adopt this regulation, for another state to adopt another regulation, makes it very, very difficult when you're attempting to do business in more than one state. And frankly, I just think that these answers really need to come from the federal government. I think the federal government has responded in some ways. There are programs in place, and there are more coming. My national association has embarked upon some programs to help educate people. One of the things that really it came down to in our discussions in the interim that I have a philosophical disagreement with respect to some of the consumer advocates who took part in that, is that, for instance, in North Carolina, mandatory counseling before you can get a loan in certain situations. Well, from my point of view, when someone wants to borrow money, there's a process that envelops. The lender has to take an application and has to look at the creditworthiness of the customer and has to decide if they will make a loan, and if they will, under what kind of parameters. Then the customer must look at that and decide if that is something that's acceptable to them. Now, are all customers well-equipped to do that? No, and I could go on at length about the need to go back into our school system and educate kids about credit, but we don't choose to make that a mandatory subject. So many of the consumer advocates really want to substitute the customer's decision-making and put in place of that some counselor, and that they will make the decision for the customer. And we just don't think that's appropriate. I'd be happy to answer some questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Kitts has a question.
I just want to clarify. You said 38 times over 3 years?
The Department of Justice, Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, the Department of Justice presented 38 bona fide complaints, or, well, 38 complaints that they had had relative to what they considered predatory lending in a three-year period. Now, I must say in their defense, however, they don't have jurisdiction over predatory lending practices. That jurisdiction lies with DCBS. So, at best, they're forwarding those on either to them or to the Fed or to somebody else. So, but yes.
Follow up. At what number would you deem it to be a problem?
I'm not sure, Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, I'm not sure I can answer that question. I think you have to compare the number of complaints and examine those complaints as to what the real complaint was, what the outcome was, and then compare that to the total number of mortgage loans made in the state. I mean, we make hundreds of thousands of mortgage loans in this state annually, I think.
One more question?
Quickly, please.
I want to just point out, when you mentioned like credit cards and giving them to college students as an example, making it very easy to obtain a credit card at 18 years old, I can assure you it's probably easier for me to get a credit card at 18 than it was at 28 as a result of it being so easy at 18. So I would like to just point out for the record that if it is a problem, I think one time is too much. I don't think we need 38. And if it happens once, I would rather address the situation before it gets to be a problem where you came here and said we had 3,800. But I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3088. And I'd like to make the announcement on two of the bills. House Bill 3148 is not ready, does not have its amendments. If you're here for that bill, we won't be hearing it. House Bill 3021, the amendments are also not ready, so they will not be heard this evening. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2881, have staff read the summary, and we'll call Bob Shipwreck. And Meg Reinhold. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2081, we heard last Friday, modifies exceptions to requirement that worker must notify employer, insurer, or self-insured employer of workers' compensation claim within 90 days after an accident. We had some dash ones last week. They didn't come out right, so we have dash twos in your packets for you this evening.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Shipwreck, Executive Secretary of the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. I think Megan's adequately stated we had a little glitch in the LC amendments. They've been corrected, and you heard my testimony, I believe, a week ago as to the fact that we wanted to provide a little bit of flexibility for injured workers. This bill is being unanimously approved by the AMLAC committee, and we should support it. I'll answer any questions.
Questions for Bob? Okay, I don't see any questions, so thank you very much. Committee, you have your amendments in your packet, which it was basically the lines 20 through 24 were supposed to be 18 through 24.
Madam Chair,
Representative Rosenbaum.
I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2881.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the dash 2 amendment into House Bill 2881. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair,
Representative Rosenbaum.
I move House Bill 2881 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 2881 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Votes aye. Motion carries, and we will have Representative Hansen carry this bill. And we will close the work session. Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2967. And have Megan read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2967 requires agencies to prepare small business economic impact statements before adopting rule. It specifies contents of impact statement. It requires agencies to conduct regulatory flexibility analysis for a rule with adverse impact on small businesses to determine if there is alternative regulatory method that would lessen the rule's adverse impact on the small business while accomplishing the same goals. And it declares an emergency effective on passage. You have some dash one amendments in your packet today. Specifies failure to prepare economic impact statement or regulatory flexibility analysis does not affect the validity or effective date of any rule, and a court may determine if a statement was prepared or not, make any determination as to the sufficiency of the statement. And also requires each agency to periodically review rules no less than every 5 years. And request a fiscal on this bill. We have not received that back yet on the dash ones.
Dash ones. Okay. Call J.L. Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing NFIB, the Small Business Flexibility Regulatory Flexibility Act. Just to go over the amendments and how they substantially changed the original bill. We changed the number of employees that qualify for small business down from 500 to 100. Instead of on Section 4, in response to Representative Merkley's question, could you invoke judicial review because they did not describe any less intrusive or less costly alternative method of achieving the purpose of the proposed rule? We deleted that. There was question about judicial review, whether it was proper to stop a rule wholesale because they did not meet the intent or did not adequately do the small business impact statement. In both Section 4 and 5, we amended the judicial review in a way that it does not affect the validity or the effective date of the rule. I want to be very clear about that. The judicial review amendments in place do not affect the validity or effective date of the rule. The court could only determine if the small business economic impact statement was prepared, and it does not make any determination as to the sufficiency. Also, one last change. We deleted this part in Section 5, Sub 3, which threw the rule over to the Economic and Community Development Department for them to advise and assist agencies in conducting the analysis. The testimony from the department was that it would, in fact, cause a fiscal burden on them, and I was not interested in doing that. So those are the effects of the amendments. I'm sure that there is probably some fiscal, I don't know what it could possibly be, but I'm sure there will be some fiscal impact, even if it's minimal. I'm hoping that the savings from going from a three-year to a five-year rule review might mitigate that in some respect. I also want to make clear, you know, to a very large extent, agencies are already required to do what this bill does. See, this bill beefs up the effects of rules on business section starting in 183.540. But in 183.335, agencies are already supposed to do an impact statement for business. 183.540, they are supposed to do an alternative statement, much like I asked. Our bill just is more specific with what we asked. I would suggest as a strategy, you know, there are three bills that really talk about the regulatory climate and what to do about regulation in the state of Oregon. 2967 is one of them. 3120 is another, pending in Representative Girard's committee. House Bill 3584 is the third. That is in trade and economic development. One of the problems is you've got probably the three biggest bills dealing with regulation in three different committees. So I guess I would say, if nothing else, a strategy of compiling them in one committee on the Senate would probably be helpful. And whether mine is the one that survives or 3120, as was on the speaker's list, which I'm guessing is going to survive, I don't care. But to address the problem in some way is sufficient for me. But 2967 is the vehicle we set out to do it at the beginning of session, so that's what I forward to you.
Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. And there's no one else to testify, correct? Oh, we're doing it. So. All right.
Madam Chair?
Representative Kitts.
I would move House Bill 2967 to the floor. Excuse me.
The dash one.
I move to accept the dash one amendment to 2967.
Representative Kitts moves the dash one amendment into House Bill 2967. Is there discussion? Objection. Saying that's so ordered.
Not on the amendment.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kitts.
I would move House Bill 2967 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2967 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the work that went into this bill and the thought that went into it, but my concern is that we are facing probably the worst crisis that the state has known in terms of government's challenge to perform the duties that we're currently charged with, and that to put an additional burden on agencies right now, however meritorious it might be, could be the straw that breaks the camel's back. I am concerned that this does have a fiscal impact that we don't know what it is, and that makes me nervous too, and therefore reluctantly I must vote no.
Okay, Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I'm going to agree with Representative Rosenbaum on her first part of her statement. I think our state is in a crisis, and that's why I will support this bill and require the state to realize what it's doing to small business in our state before they do it.
Okay. The fact that it didn't have a subsequent referral indicates that those who were referring bills believe it would be under $50,000. Other comments? Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the number of changes that Mr. Wilson has brought forward, all of which substantially improve this bill. I think that it does make sense to have a process where the impact on small businesses is analyzed. We've had a lot of discussion in the last 6 months during the gubernatorial campaign and afterwards about the role of regulations in supporting or distracting from the success of business in our state. I wasn't prepared to support the bill in its original form. It had a number of inconsistencies and excessive burdens, really, as I saw it. I can't tell you right now whether or not the amendment solves all of those problems, but I think it goes an enormous way towards solving them, and that the discussion should continue, and whether the bill stands exactly where it is or has additional issues addressed in the Senate. So I appreciate the changes that are proposed, and I'll be supporting the bill.
Thank you. Other comments?
Member Corcoran, just ask a question. If the fiscal impact comes back and is in excess of that threshold, what would happen at that point?
We would pull the bill. If it's over $50,000, you know, we will make the decision. We can pull it back to committee. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Votes aye. Motion carries. And Representative Kitts, would you carry the bill?
Happy to.
Close the work session on 2967. Okay, we're going to go to House Bill 2737, opening a work session, and I'll call Jim Gardner and Jim Craven. And I will announce that the Dash 5 amendments arrived very late, and so we're not going to move this today, but we are taking the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, excuse me, it's late. For the record, Jim Craven with the American Electronics Association, Oregon Council. We're a national trade association that represents the high-tech industry both here in Oregon and across the country. I do appreciate all the hard work that's gone into this bill. You had one brief hearing several weeks ago. I can't remember when. You may remember that Representative Haas came in and brought a constituent who had a doctor, as I recall, who had had her domain name absconded by some kind of bad actor. And we talked about that. We talked about the general issue of unsolicited commercial email, so-called spam. And this is the result, the Dash 5s that you have before you, result of a lot of effort. This is just my walking around file that I brought with me tonight. This isn't the entire thing. Representative Merkley has been very, very active, spent many, many hours on helping on this. Representative Haas and his staff have been involved in this. Senator Metzger from the Senate side. So we bring in you today, I think, a bill that is perhaps one of the best bills in the United States on this issue. We are benefiting somewhat by being a little bit late. Something like 20-some-odd states have already legislated in this arena. We've learned a little bit from their both positive and negatives and tried to involve an awful lot of people in this process. Let me just mention a couple things. We can do whatever the chair chooses as far as the details of the bill, and Mr. Gardner can walk you through, and Representative Merkley is pretty familiar with all the ins and outs. What we've tried to do here is there's a double test. I won't go through all the language and the lines, but there are two basic kind of tests here. There are what we've called in the work group the bad actors. These are people who steal your domain name, who use your email address in order to forward spam, so-called spam, really sort of fraudulent, truly bad behavior. That's part of the bill. The other is just simply unsolicited commercial email. Please buy my product. And so there are various tests in the bill and tests in the penalty section of the bill that say there's a distinction between that. There's a distinction between somebody who is a legitimate business selling a legitimate product and sending you an email asking you to do that versus people who are doing what you would call fraud or truly bad or illegal behavior. And so the bill makes a distinction between those, and it's a key distinction in the bill. The main element of this bill is that people who send commercial email will need to put the letters ADV colon in the subject line of the bill. That seems to be the way most states are going in the United States in addressing this issue. And what that allows you to do, either if you get an email that says ADV, you can hit the delete button if you choose to. You can also work with your ISP or with software that you would install on your own workstation to filter out that kind of email if you just choose not to get that at all. We think in general that this is an issue that probably ultimately needs to be addressed at the federal level so we have a uniform standard in the United States. But Congress being what it is, you can't always wait for them to figure things out. There are bills similar to this working their way through Congress. I can't tell you that one will emerge this year. So Oregon's going to move ahead and following, basically trying to conform as closely as possible to what other states have done. I mean, the worst thing possible is to have 50 states with 50 different rules about how people can send email and having, you know, truly legitimate commercial people who want to solicit. I mean, it's a legal form of solicitation, just like so-called junk mail is in your home. But to put a small burden, but not a huge burden, on those kind of solicitations, and allow you as the consumer and your constituents to use that as a tool to do some filtering, to do some blocking, and to try to get a handle on what is really a growing scourge. I think most people, and I'm sure you hear this from your constituents. There's a couple key elements in the bill. Your ISP, you know, which is your AOL or your Microsoft Network or Earthlink or whatever you choose to use as the way you get email, there's some important protections for the ISPs of the world who are not the issue here. The issue is people who are sending you spam. And so there are provisions in the bill that say you can't go after the ISP just because someone sent email through your AOL account. That's a important key provision. And for the you've seen the ads on TV and such, the ISP community is using, hey, we're the best ISP to help you block spam, and you've seen the ads for AOL 8.0 and others. So there's also important protection in the bill for the ISP that is working on your behalf to try to block spam so it doesn't get to your email account, that the simple act of helping you block spam does not all of a sudden make you the ISP liable for some kind of civil offense when they're really on your side and your constituent's side in trying to help address this issue. There's a number of penalty provisions which are a bit complex, and we can go through them at whatever length that the committee wishes to hear about the various civil penalties that result from violations of this act. But basically, I think we have a pretty darn good bill here. I think we need to be a bit humble about this being an instantaneous solution that will solve. I probably wouldn't put in your constituent newsletter that they'll never get any bad email again once we pass this bill, but it's a tool and it's a start, and really the focus ought to be on providing a tool both for the Attorney General's office and for individuals and for ISPs to really go after the truly bad actors. I mean, I think that's what, you know, and you know what they are, and I'm too embarrassed to actually mention the kinds of things that people get in their email here in a public hearing, but we're trying to provide a tool to go after those people who commit fraud, who steal your email address, and who send you very, you know what I'm talking about, kinds of indelicate types of email, and provide an enforcement tool to really go after the bad actors without, you know, involving people who are doing pure commercial solicitation for real products that you may wish to actually see in your email and take advantage of. So that's the overall architecture without going through line by line, but we can do whatever level of detail committee wishes.
Well, thank you, Jim. That's very complete, and I have flashed through here and saw most of what you have said. I did want to ask, since it is Representative Hass's bill, has he signed off on these amendments?
I believe his staff is here. Tried to make Representative Hass stay, but turned it over
him
to Jason.
For the record, my name is Jason Skelton. I'm legislative aide to Representative Hass. A few minor drafting changes are all Representative Hass would like to make, but as I understand, it's a late hour, and so we've got to get this bill out so it doesn't die. Great bill, just a few small drafting changes we can make on the Senate side. I can point those out to you if you'd like.
Sure.
Okay. A couple big ones. Section 4 of the bill. It's page 3. It talks about a prior business relationship. It says has or had. So that would mean if you've ever had a business relationship with anyone, they can spam you and you can't stop them. So we just want to keep it as has. If you have a business relationship or are you the predecessor. What else? The definition of ISP, that's in Section 2, Sub 5. I share it with the AG's office, kind of allowing her expertise from this and the tech guys. But basically, that definition is kind of broad. It's essentially a spammer can be included in that definition. Acts as an intermediary. So if a company asks a spammer to spam you, well, they're an intermediary because they've asked you to do something there in between. And the second piece is provides to end users the ability to send or receive electronic email. Basically, if a spammer sends you some spam and they put a link at the bottom that says if you want to opt out, click here. You click on that, an email opens up, and then you send them an email. So that's providing you the means to send an email. Cheryl has a good definition that would replace this, and so we apply just to ISPs. And then finally, the remedy provisions. Basically, the way it's, that's in Section 5, I think is where it's put it. He has $10. That's what the original bill has. We'd like to see that increased. For example, like if the ADV portion, someone sends you a pornographic email, for example, and a child would open it up, $10, it seems like it would be difficult to prove damages in that circumstance. So $10 seems a little nominal. So say $100, or $200, which is what the Unfair Trade Practices Act, with this is encompassed within that, that's the amount they use. So $200, we'd like that amount to be put in there, whichever is greater, or your actual damages, whichever is greater. And that those are the big changes that we can do those on the Senate side. So get this out.
Okay, I appreciate that. I don't see a problem with those changes, and maybe you'd like to comment too, gentlemen. Friday is our last day. We would have to move it, and because the amendments were late, that's why we can't move it tonight, because not everybody's seen it. So would you like to comment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. We would suggest that we address those remedy issues on the Senate side, because there are the issue of the proper level of damages for ADV violations is a somewhat sensitive one. As a practical matter, these lend themselves to aggregation in the form of class actions, and the amount I think is something we need to discuss a little bit further, and we propose to do that and address the other issues on the Senate side with the chair's indulgence.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm closing the work session. Is that all that was signed up? I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2737. And thank you, Representative Merkley, for working on that bill. It's a great help to us.
We just have the margin multiplied by the number of Nigerian money laundering letters that we've received here at the Capitol.
Either way.
Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3392, and the drafter of the bill is not here. So we're just going to briefly take the testimony of those who have come to testify on this, and we will not intend to move this bill either today. The staff will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3392 exempts minors employed in agricultural labor from minimum wage and overtime requirements.
Hi. Have a seat and we'd be happy to take your testimony. This is Ann. Are you Ann?
Yes.
Ann Falcon, I'm calling. And Joseph?
Joseph, yes.
Joseph
Bosquez.
Bosquez. Welcome.
Thank you. I'll go first. Okay. My testimony is I'm opposing this bill. Madam Chair and the members of the committee. My name is Joseph Bosquez. I'm a member of LUS, which is Latinos Unidos Siempre. It's a youth organization here in Salem. I'm here to advocate for keeping the current minimum wage laws that cover youth under the age of 18. These youth who work in the fields deserve the same pay as any other person doing the same hard work. Most of these youth who work on the fields throughout the seasons to help their family, help their families barely survive. We must remember, as our representatives, that we, the voters, approved minimum wage increase back in November. The reason was that we, the voters, recognized that the cost of living has gone up and it's just fair to give workers a wage increase that is still less than the living wage. Thank you.
Thank you. Anna.
Excuse me. Dear representatives, my name is Anna Falcon. I'm a resident of Salem, Oregon, and I'm currently attending McNary High School. I'm here today to represent LUS, which stands for Latinos Unidos Siempre, a youth organization which has been based out of Oregon since 1996. I'm here to talk on behalf of over 300 youth that belong to this organization that feel that HB 3392 would hurt and cause more bad than good to the youth in our communities. LUS is a community-based organization whose majority of youth come from farm worker backgrounds. So we know firsthand that it is essential for this youth to earn at least, if not more, the minimum wage that has been established here in Oregon for our residents. The minimum wage law that was passed was to aid Oregonians with the increase in living costs. This is giving many of residents of Oregon a chance to better their financial situations. As we all know, workers in the agricultural sector have one of the lowest household incomes than any other sectors. This bill will not only make it harder for families that count on the added income of youth in their family to bring the needed extra income into the home. By continuing to allow youth that work in the agricultural sector to gain the set minimum wage, we are enabling them to better their financial situations, which we all know can be very hard and negative effects on family. As it is, many of our youth that come from farm worker backgrounds have the lowest percentage of graduation and youth that continue to higher education. One of the barriers that stop many of these youth is the financial burden that is felt on the family, forcing many Oregon students to leave school and go into the workforce to make ends meet. The minimum wage law that is in effect now allows many of these youth to overcome this barrier and at the same time contribute to their family's income so they may better themselves to continue giving to their communities. And Latinos Unidos Siempre urges youth not allow Hearing Bill 3392 to continue on. It would dramatically affect the lives of Oregon youth that work hard and have earned their right to receive minimum wage and whose added income is bloodline to their family's success. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming. Representative Gord.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to congratulate and thank both of these young people representing Latino youth. The fact that you're involved in the political system and here tonight testifying on something you feel strongly about is something we applaud.
Yeah.
So thank you for coming.
And may I compliment you on your letterhead? That's very striking.
Oh, thank you.
Madam Chair.
I started baling hay when I was 12 years old, and the farmers I worked for would have been ashamed
of themselves to pay me. I always got paid more than minimum wage. And this is just a slap in the face to working people in America.
Yes,
and I want to I appreciate and I thank you for coming here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No, okay, sir.
Thank you very much.
It wouldn't be a good hearing if we didn't have a good speech from Representative Shoffler.
Yes, it would.
For making our evening complete.
We're going to make him go down and testify, though, instead of doing it from up here. Okay, we'll call Ed Gladden, Steve Lanning.
Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ed Glad, and I appreciate being able to sit next to someone from the labor movement, but I took my carpenter's pin off today because I come to you not as a member of the labor movement, but as a farmer and as an employer of young people to do agricultural work. I married a piece of property. My wife owned this piece of property, and she would not move when I married her 7 years ago. And it had an incredible scotch broom infection on the property. We live 7 miles outside of the town of Yamhill, which is out in the middle of nowhere, if you've ever traveled the county of Yamhill. But 7 miles out is where the farmlands end and the tree farms begin. Well, Lemon Industries is huge there. And we own probably the last piece of acreage that you could actually farm. Somebody had cleared it out many, many years ago, probably 100 years ago, and made a homestead there. But when I came across this land 7 years ago, there was a scotch broom infection on the land. So big that the scotch broom grew to 10 feet tall, and the stalks were an inch and a half wide. My problem wasn't the scotch broom in itself, because everybody in the neighborhood were coaching me and saying, you need to use chemicals, but I couldn't do that. Because there was a winery next to me, a vineyard. You can't use chemicals next to a vineyard. You destroy it. So I was faced with the dilemma of being a trade union person all of my life. I grew up in the construction industry. I started working when I was 12 years old. And now I own this huge piece of property, 80 acres, that we're converting to forest lands. In order to be able to clear that land, I have to hire my children and their friends in order to be able to cut this scotch broom by hand. The minimum wage was a huge challenge for me as a landowner, as a forester, and certainly as a father. But I set myself to my principles coming out of the urban area and going to work. And I realized that paying that kind of wage to the kids in the neighborhood and my own kids was a huge challenge to me financially. I married a piece of property. I have sunk everything into this thing. Remember this. In order to be able to have a training wage, a minimum wage, it's the employer's responsibility to teach the person that is underage what it means to work. That's what this wage does. It doesn't simply compensate the worker, but it challenges the employer to teach the young kids. This isn't about people who are adults. This is about young kids, that if they can't meet that challenge, that they can't work. So my kids start at 12 years old, and they have to watch me work in order to understand what that minimum wage means. And not until they can demonstrate they can do that hour after hour will they be able to work. So I have found that the challenge of the minimum wage is that we are responsible as adults to teach children how to work and what that dollar means. Now my kids and all of their friends have saved that minimum wage, and that's how they're going to go to college. My oldest is 18, and next year he wants to go to college. That's how he saves his money. And I'll tell you, there isn't a kid in that neighborhood, and we're talking 25 miles square, that hasn't come and tried to work on my property. And there isn't one that has lasted one full job. They have gotten laid off, and I tell them, if you want to work for me, you have to meet this minimum wage. That's what it means to be a parent. I'm parent to many, many kids. And they go out and they work on the other farms around, and they buck hay. My kid can buck hay all day long, despite the fact that he's asthmatic. But he learned how to work, because I told him what the minimum wage was. That's what I was paying him. But I worked side by side with him, and I taught him what it means to earn a dollar. And I'll tell you something. All the kids that work in agriculture, they work their butts off. They don't come very long, and it's not my responsibility to teach them exactly what to do. My responsibility is to own up and say, you're not doing what's expected of you at that wage. That's what it means to be a father, and that's what it means to be a member of my community. And I'll tell you something, those kids know how to work. That's what agriculture gives us, is a workforce that knows how to work because they've been in those conditions. And being someone who has sunk every nickel of my fortune into this farm, I'm telling you that I can't afford another nickel to pay minimum wage. But I am so proud of what I've produced out of those kids on how to work and what we're going to get off that property. I'm here not as a trade unionist. I'm here simply as a father saying the minimum wage is something that you should preserve and make sure that those kids learn how to do it and that nobody abuses their children to pay them less or abuses their children to continue to pay them. That's the challenge. You pay them too much, you have to lay them off, and you say, come back when you're ready to work. That's what the minimum wage is.
Well, thank you, Ed. That's fascinating. We'd like a list of your children and their phone numbers.
Eli's ready.
And Steve.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Lanning, and I represent the Oregon AFL-CIO. And we're opposed to House Bill 3392. Our organization doesn't represent minors in agricultural work, but in the seven sessions that I was I've been here representing the Oregon AFL-CIO, in previous sessions I've seen farm worker minors come in and testify before committee, and I was it's an experience that I didn't have and I didn't see, but I listened, and I saw kids that were 12 years old and 13 years old and 14 years old and even older talk about their experience working in fields and working hard hours and working 60 hours a week. They came in and told their stories, and I realized that that young folks in agricultural employment work hard. They really do work hard, and they're not taking the minimum wage to buy CDs and concert tickets. They're buying basic necessities, and they're helping out their families. And so we're opposed to this bill, and we hope it doesn't move and doesn't pass. Thanks.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
I just wanted to clarify something. I think one of the witnesses mentioned a training wage, but my reading of this bill is that it just exempts people who are under 18 from the minimum wage, but doesn't specify any alternative. So I would read as saying you could pay as little as you like, and there's nothing that specifies
they won't work.
Minimum.
Those kids won't work. The neighbor kids won't come by. The only way that I can attract them to come and work on the farm, and I'm not the only person in this valley. They won't work. And when you say, oh, well, I'm going to pay you less, they won't do it. This minimum wage is minimum for all sorts of areas, but it's really a huge problem.
Okay.
When you have tennis shoes that cost $75, $80, $150, some of these kids are wearing tennis shoes $150. They won't come out and waste their time. They'll do something else. And so it is a training wage. Minimum wage is the training wage, and you should keep it there. And to lower it any lower is crazy for our workforce, for our future.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on 3392. Again, the bill sponsor is not here. We will not intend to move that bill. I'm going to open a work session on 2665, and we had also expected that bill sponsor to be here, but he is not here, and I'm not going to ask you to wait any longer. This has a referral to Ways and Means, so, and what this is, Megan, you want to read this, sorry?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2665 establishes a tobacco retailer incentive fund, authorizes transfer of money from tobacco settlement funds account to tobacco retailer incentive funds, and authorizes use of monies in fund to reward tobacco retailers who do not sell tobacco to minors.
Okay.
If it is the pleasure of the committee, we can move this to Ways and Means without recommendation. If someone wants to make that motion.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kitts.
I would move House Bill 2665 to the Committee on Ways and Means with no recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2665 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2665. And is there anything else for the good of the committee? Thank you, everyone, for your patience tonight. Have a good evening. We're adjourned. Tomorrow morning.